And this is the People's Game, KPFK Radio, Pacifica Radio's 2010 World Cup Soccer Show, where we look at the games on the field as well as the economic, political, and cultural subtext of the world's most popular event, the World Cup Soccer Tournament. And before we get going today, I want to note that for the first two-thirds of the run of this show, we used a song called, what was it, 2K or no, 2K10 in South Africa. And the producer of the song actually passed away, and there was a marvelous segment on Radio Aphrodisia here on KPFK, both honoring the producer and talking about the World Cup tournament and the song. And I will actually access that segment of that interview with DJ Namdi and put it up on the People's Game website in the coming days. So you'll see that at www.thepeoplesgame.org. Well, we switched over to one of my all-time favorite songs, Master Blaster, by Stevie Wonder, in part because it's a song that really celebrates post-colonial African independence. And later on in the show, we're going to actually hear something that I voiced, an essay by Laurent Dubois, who's been a guest on this show. He's written a book called Soccer Empire. We had an extended interview with him early, and we also talked about the French team going into the tournament, and then also a little bit about the French team as it unraveled during the tournament. And he has a marvelous essay called Black Star Tragedy. He was at the Ghana-Uruguay match, and his reflections on the experience as he was pulling for Ghana in what probably will be, along with the finals, whatever takes place in the finals on Sunday, midday here in Southern California. Finals are, of course, always memorable, but up to this point, that's the most memorable moment of the tournament, I think, by far. There were many dramatic moments, but what transpired at the end of the Ghana-Uruguay match. Well, I'm joined in studio here by
Pablo Morales,
Jennifer Doyle,
and I'm Al Aminsky. And what we're going to start out today with is a roundtable among the three of us talking about our reflections on the tournament. Then we're going to be joined by Hector Tobar of the LA Times. And then we're going to hear again the essay, A Black Star Tragedy, by Laurent Dubois. And then we're going to take listener phone calls in the final 20 minutes of the show, where we want to know a few things, your thoughts about the 2010 World Cup tournament, one of the big subjects we've had here about soccer gaining traction or not here in the United States, interesting essay in the LA Times by R.L. Dorfman today about that, and also who you think's going to win among the final four teams, and maybe also if you still care, given the fact that Ghana and some of the other top most favorite teams are out of the tournament currently. So Pablo and Jennifer, I'm Al Aminsky, by the way. Pablo and Jennifer, what's on your minds about the 2010 World Cup tournament as we head to the semifinals tomorrow?
I feel like I'm living in a cave. I can't wait for it to be over at this point. I have no idea who to root for anymore. It's been all turned upside down, and normally I guess I would be rooting for Spain, looking at who we've got left. I would like to root for Uruguay, but I can't now. They've been destroyed by La Mano del Diablo and Suarez and all of that, all of the Ghanaian drama, which is unfortunate because I would like to see a South American team win. It would be great, but I just don't want to see them win this way. I just think it's absolutely awful. So I'm trying to bury my head in other subjects for the moment.
Well, much like the Spain Paraguay match that we saw, there seems to be little to expect from Holland versus Uruguay, especially given so many players now absent from Uruguay, including Suarez himself. Only really Forlan is up there in terms of any offensive creativity, that we will really expect to see Uruguay pack into a defensive shell. And
we thought we were going to have a game with Germany-Argentina, and mm-hmm. Germany just rolled over them. And I think a lot of people underestimated Ghana. I mean, Ghana very nearly, and they, by all rights, actually should be have advanced.
Oh, so, of course, yeah.
I mean, you just never know. I mean, you absolutely just, you never know. Maybe I'm naive for thinking that, but I would love to see Uruguay slaughtered in the next
Wow.
I'm not convinced that's going to happen.
There's no getting at Suarez at any rate. But but I do want to say this too, and there's been an absolute avalanche. I think about I haven't seen any article really defending the current Dutch strategies. In fact, you know, article after article about it. This is not total football. This is not beautiful football. This is win at all costs Dutch football, which we haven't seen ever because we only started paying attention to Dutch football when they started playing total football. So there's not a lot of glow on the Dutch team either.
No, it's. But I think like most teams that are still left in the tournament, they're a lot of their strategy, so to speak, is really based on what their personnel is on the field. Right now, Holland's primary forward, Van Persie, is not having a great tournament. They're just not. He's not. It's like Torres for Spain. It's just not the same team as we were seeing, for example, 2 years ago at the European Championships. The midfields are dominating. To say that. You know, we're not seeing Dutch football. It's probably true. The only team that actually seems to be playing with any kind of, like, structure is Germany.
Right, and I was surprised not to hear you say you were pulling for Germany because you've been very favorably disposed towards them.
I appreciate some of the things that are going on for them. So I appreciate that they were an underestimated side. You know, they're a side that traditionally goes into a tournament with a lot of expectations, but that was not true for this tournament. And I'd spoken before earlier this week about the suicide of Robert Anka, their goalkeeper in the fall, and the way that may have brought the team together, and the fact that the team has pledged some of the bonuses that they win from this tournament to the Robert Anka Foundation, which supports the research and treatment of depression in especially athletes, which is a really noble cause and a taboo subject, certainly within competitive sports at this level. I think this has been not really talked about enough, actually, but perhaps we'll see more of kind of personal profiles of the team by the networks. Lord knows we're going to see lots of that kind of stuff in the next few days. But, I'm starting to feel sort of indifferent. There's a wonderful story or post by Supriya Nair, who we had on this show, on her blog, Treason, Stratagems, and Spoils, in which she really takes us pundits, us folks who are sort of constantly seeking for some kind of metaphorical meaning out of all of this stuff, to task for being so eager often to see in every team and every notable new player an allegory for some kind of, you know, historical problem or trauma. And she actually does, she kind of schools us, I think, in that article on how it's done. And insofar, she actually moves from quite specific technical analysis to a discussion of the politics of the game without engaging in, for example, as does, I've forgotten his first name, is Cohen in the New York Times, wrote an article about Mesut Ozil and German immigration policies and sort of seeing in Ozil this kind of redemptive figure, you know, and she's like, well, you know, we don't want that kind of this moment of for Ozil to turn into a platform through which people, in essence, say to, for example, Turkey, so, hey, we're cool now, right? Like, after all the garbage that's been dumped on you, all of the kind of hyper-symbolic, you know, roles that you've been forced to play, or the regimes that have been forced upon you.
Sounds like,
you know,
she's saying that you can make too much of this, she's making a similar case herself.
Well, she's doing the opposite.
No, it's not the opposite. Yeah. It's just the point in counterpoint, because, after all, this happened in this country writ large on a plane which isn't football, but maybe much more imbalanced, which is electoral politics with the election of Barack Obama, and all of a sudden racism is it's not.
Yeah, but it goes to go back to the French situation, right? One of the tricky things with the 98 side and with this kind of multicultural French national team is the ease with which the celebration of that team turns into a national forgetting of the problem of racism and France's immigration policies and the situation of those sans-papiers. Like, that's what she's talking about, is like, okay, hold on, right? And then she's also pointing out, too, and we see this a lot, I think, in the big newspapers especially, there's been a lot of criticism or sort of a wild, I don't know if extrapolation is quite the right word, a theorization of the failure of African teams in their World Cup campaigns as resting upon being too invested in the big man. So this is a very specific point that's made by Cohen in the New York Times. And she's like, this is really not, you can't make connections between what's going on with these teams and what's going on with each individual country and the history of each individual country within the continent of Africa. And there's a lot of that that's happening in terms of the kind of, in terms of the punditry within newspapers. And unfortunately, newspapers and the mass media are not always great outlets for complexity. So, but again, Treason, Stratagems, and Spoils, I think, is a blog that a lot of KPFK listeners, I think, would really enjoy for its critical edge and the originality of her points.
Right, and the interview with her we did a while back was really great, so you can find that again on the People's Game website or the KPFK audio archives.
Well, okay. You know, I want to go back to something that was said earlier about the you know, the demonization. I love the mano de diablo, but, you know, as a former fullback, I'm sorry, but that ball's going in the net, you stick your hand up, you knock it down because 85-90% chance of a goal is better than 100%, especially late in the game when, you know, the whole everything's on the line. And everything is on the line in a quarterfinal of a World Cup where your team hasn't been in, you know, the position to be a semifinalist in for Uruguay since 1970, mm-hmm. and for Paraguay, for Ghana ever. So I have no problem with him doing that. Mm-hmm. There's 3 million very happy Uruguayans, very happy he did that. And so I just wanted to throw that out.
Yeah, we'd actually had a conversation earlier, which was a conversation between people who play, right, who know that this is actually the kind of thing you're coached to do.
Absolutely.
Right? This isn't like the dirty secret of soccer. You're told, you know, if that ball goes out, you pick up that ball like it's yours, even if you know it's not, and like the referee make the decision. Right. Right? Don't take responsibility for refereeing the game yourself. Your job is to play it and to win it. And that's basic coaching advice.
Well, he made an unbelievably heroic play literally a second or 2 seconds before when he blocked the ball off the goal
with
his feet.
That's true.
And then, of course, there wasn't going to be any more of the game left to play. Now, it's true he would be one of the better penalty takers, but clearly the ball's going in the net. There weren't going to be penalties.
Right.
And he stepped up and did what he did. But it's interesting because, you'll hear the essay that Laurent Dubois wrote about this. And he was at the game in Soccer mm-hmm. City in Johannesburg. And from where he was, of course, maybe he just was unaware that it was Suarez because he refers to him as the Uruguayan defender. And, of course, he was defending at the moment.
Yeah.
Right.
But, this guy was a striker.
Right.
Who did this? And I feel that. And at the same time, as I said in the show on Saturday, it is it takes a lot of the luster off the tournament the fact that it's not Ghana versus Holland, and then it's Uruguay versus Holland. It's a really weakened Uruguay versus Holland. And I'd love to have seen Ghana go through just on the plane of soccer. But then on the plane again, this goes back to your initial point, which is how much does Ghana's success moving into the semifinals, redeem the history of post-colonial Africa, let alone post-colonial African soccer. But it is something so many millions upon millions of people wanted at a ratio of about 1 million to 1, considering the population of Uruguay.
That's true.
Well, before we go to Hector Tobar, and I think we're going to get him on the line in a minute, I'm really interested in talking a little bit about this German team.
Mm.
And again, it's hard for me not to think about the essay from the website you mentioned, Stratagems, Treasons, and...
Treasons, Stratagems, and Spoils.
Right, because I do think that what's going on with the German team, it's not anything to just draw out and say that this is a metaphor about contemporary German society, but I do think it's hard sometimes not to make those connections in your mind or you leap to it. I mean, there has been this sort of misrepresentation broadly shared around the world in post-World War II era of Germany being not a happy place, a gray and rainy, downtrodden, and then Berlin is some paradox as this, party capital or whatever, but that's the way people see it. And in fact, what we're getting is the most joyous soccer of the tournament on the field played by the German side with, again, the second straight really upbeat manager, really upbeat team. And this idea of this strategy too. I'm very interested in what you were talking about, the 19 squares. Intrigued
18,
me.
Actually. 18? It's just this
19 would have been even more intriguing.
It would have been absolutely. How did they get 19 equal squares out of a rectangle?
Yeah.
No, it's actually 18. Lowe, the coach for Germany, said that their strategy is basically that he divides – I'll quote it here – divides the pitch into 18 rectangles of the same size to determine where the players should be positioned. I mean, that just seems so regimented for a team that plays so free-flowing.
Yeah.
He says, and this is a quote that just reeks of German to me, it's all about order on the pitch. It's the most important condition for good football, order. And I just think that it's just kind of funny because you don't really see that necessarily, but if you do look at how they're always in a position to receive the ball in space –
right.
You think about this team, this German team. It's a young team. There's not a lot of big superstars. Possibly a good thing that Ballack didn't make the team this year because there's really not a lot of big egos on the field. I think that Ballack has a huge ego.
Mm.
And I think that they're playing for each other and they're playing for their coach. And of course there's the element of the former goalkeeper who passed away. So I just think it's a fascinating story that this team has gotten as far as they have. It's very interesting. What do you guys think?
Well, I think that actually there's a bit of a paradox when you look at 18 squares or rectangles in the obviously rectangular field of a soccer pitch,
it
suggests this sort of hyper-organized, hyper-order. But in fact, if you're demanding that the players are covering the entire field, that actually runs counter to the way things tend to get channeled into the middle. And you look at the German attacks recently, and you do have people coming down the touchline, you know, as Schweinsteiger's move there, and it really opens up the field and might be part of their flow. But, you know, again, it's just... And I'm reluctant to root for them. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, watching Soccer Made in Germany, hosted by the great Toby Charles. It must be. It is. It's in the back of the net, right? Watching all those Gerd Müller goals and stuff. And it was a fantastic league at the time in the mid-70s. But I root against them simply as an Azzurri fan. I couldn't embrace the Azzurri. But you have to understand, if you're a Brazilian, Italian, or German fan, you're looking at in terms of 5 stars for Brazil, 4 for Italy, 3 for Germany. So I'm just compelled not to want to see Germany to equal Italy. Yeah. You know, with 4 World Cup titles.
To go back to that issue of the order and the kind of the typing of the German game along stereotypes about Germanness, I thought I should remind listeners too of Arsene Wenger, right? He's the coach for Arsenal, a team which is famous/notorious for playing a beautiful game that perhaps even sacrifices the desire to win it all in order to play the beautiful game. He is notoriously technical. He measures the amount of time each player holds onto the ball, the percentage rates for their completed passes. He has an actuarial perspective on the game. It is intensely mathematical and very, very intriguing for that. And that is the inner architecture for what registers to us as spectators watching the game, is a very fluid and relational game in which players seem to always know, you know, intuitively where the other is. And that allows for exactly the kind of beautiful footwork and passing game that is most pleasing to the eye.
And another coach that really loves the young players that haven't already formed, you know, an identity. He likes to really take them young and mold them in his likeness.
And while he's Belgian, he's a disciple of Cruyff. And I think one of the things that people should remember is while total football came out of Holland, and of course everybody remembers that the Dutch played the Germans in 74, that style of play of the national leagues, it penetrated the Bundesliga of the top leagues more than it ever did the Premiership or La Liga, except for Barcelona, which is a Cruyff disciple team, and much more than Serie A. So there's a lot of total football and overlap with Wenger in the Bundesliga. Well, we're joined right now by Hector Tobar on the phone. Hector Tobar, of course, is a fantastic reporter and writer for the Los Angeles Times and a frequent guest here on KPFK Radio. And he has some interesting reflections that he's posted recently about the 2010 World Cup. Welcome to the People's Game, Hector Tobar.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Great. So I understand you had a posting today that I know that Pablo thought
was yesterday. But go ahead.
I had a moment of nationalistic outrage. You know, I'm a pretty cosmopolitan guy. I root for the U.S. national team, even though I'm of Guatemalan descent, and you know I'm not really fiercely loyal to my Guatemalan identity. But when I heard the one Guatemalan participant in the FIFA 2010 World Cup, Carlos Matres, be insulted by not one but two different commentators, essentially for his Guatemalan-ness, I had to say something. And so on my Facebook page, I made a little posting encouraging people to write to ESPN to protest the outrage of Steve McManaman, a wonderful Liverpool winger in his day and now a commentator for ESPN, suggesting that my compatriota Carlos Matres should not have been allowed to referee the quarterfinal match between Paraguay and Spain merely because he's Guatemalan, and that doesn't make him important enough to referee a game of that stature. Mr. McManaman had a problem with a couple of calls that Batres made, which a lot of commentators thought were actually quite brave to call, you know, 3 penalty kicks in a row. And so I made my feelings known via the social networking sites and encouraged my friends to do the same.
Yeah, I just think it's great because, you know, it's the kind of slight that so many people outside of United States and Central America, you know, just let go. You know, this sort of like, oh, well, it's just Guatemala, so to speak. You know, I always remember sort of like Gustavo Arellano saying that, you know, if Americans want to understand how the Mexicans feel about us, then just look at how Mexicans treat Guatemalans. And I just think it was really great, I think, that you stepped up at that point to say, hey, wait a minute, that's not right. And, I mean, CONCACAF in general is looked down upon as a small pond in a larger ocean of football, And I'm not saying he's a great ref because he's refed some pretty terrible games against the United States, but that was uncalled for to say it just because he's a Guatemalan, you know.
Yeah, he just implied, you know, what is this? Why does FIFA choose a Guatemalan ref for a quarter final match? And in fact, wow. He was quite praised, you know, for his decisions in that match, and also in the Italy New Zealand game where he called the penalty that allowed Italy to equalize in that match. Which a lot of neutral observers thought was a, you know, totally correct call. And in that game, it was Chilavert, the famous Paraguayan goalkeeper, another wonderful player in his day, who suggested that Mr. Batres shouldn't be refereeing at that level. So, you know, it's like the people feel they have license that because someone is from Guatemala. I mean, it's very difficult to sort of say something about a Mexican referee and allude to his Mexicanness as part of the problem. But since people perceive Guatemala to be this small and insignificant country, they feel they have license to attack someone for their nationality. And, for me, that's beyond the pale.
So. Right.
It really is. And it's symptomatic, too, of a broader lack of respect for Central American football within the sort of global footballing
right.
community, especially in England and Europe. That's something that I've certainly noticed in my travels. And it's absolutely scandalous that they'd be making such remarks at all, never mind on the air during the broadcast of a World Cup match.
Yeah, and you know, Central American football. Okay, yeah, we've had our day. Costa Rica obviously had a wonderful World Cup in 1990, making it to the second round with Hernan Medford. Guatemala has never qualified for the World Cup. I think its highlight in international football, I remember, was in the 72 Olympics, where as my uncle told me, we scored a goal against Italy. Unfortunately, Italy scored three against us. But you know, Central American soccer, not. And in this World Cup, Honduras did not have a great World Cup, but you know we've made our contribution also to the U.S. national team. We'll always remember Hugo Perez, who was the best American midfielder of his day, of Salvadoran descent in the 1990s, had a really wonderful Gold Cup in 1991. So, you know, Centroamericanos are there in both in the United States and also in their own countries contributing to soccer, and we just like to be treated with a little bit of respect. That's all.
Absolutely, and I recommend everyone who is equally outraged to get onto the ESPN website and file your complaint with ABC.
Yes, indeed. Sounds like a definite thing to do. Hector Tober, it sounds to me like you follow this tournament extremely closely, so I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you for your broad general reflections on the tournament to date. There's been a lot of refereeing controversies, obviously the Uruguayan-Ghana controversy. What teams are you disappointed to have not seen go further, and what do you think of the four teams remaining?
Oh, well, I was obviously disappointed as a longtime fan of the U.S. national team going back to the NASL, North American Soccer League days.
Oh, yeah.
I was excited to see the U.S. play as well as it did in the first round. Disappointed in our exit versus Ghana. I think it was just a case of an emotional fatigue in the first half of that game. Mm. And then in the overtime, we obviously were lacking a real sort of strong center forward who could put the ball in the back of the net. But still, just really wonderful the response of the U.S. public, especially to that Algeria game. And the images of people all over the United States, in the morning of that day, cheering Landon Donovan's winning goal. That was something that, as a U.S. fan, I mean, it wasn't even a feasible dream in the 1970s and 80s that moment will ever come. So that was wonderful. I would say I was really disappointed to see Argentina and Brazil go. Not surprised that Argentina left, considering that Maradona made some questionable choices in defense. But also just really enthused to see, as you guys were just commenting on the German team, and just the incredible ethnic diversity of the German team. We've got Tunisian, a player, you have a Bosnian, you have a
Ghanaian.
A Turk, and a couple of Poles. It's almost as ethnically diverse as the United States national team, you know. I think Germany is definitely the team to beat in this tournament. A little disappointed. I was got into a couple of arguments over the Uruguay-Ghana game because I did want to see Uruguay win. I've been to Uruguay many times and really love Montevideo and the Uruguayan people and the style of soccer played there, but that was definitely a moment of anti-football, if there ever was one. To see a player, deny a team victory with a blatant handball in the very last minute. But that's the game, and it's been a really great World Cup. We've seen some really great football. Too bad, you know, it was a little bit defensive in the first round or so of the first round. The first round of matches was a lot of defensive football, but also more parity than ever before. You know, New Zealand was strong. Really, there's only one weak tournament, North Korea, weak team in the tournament, North Korea, who had one bad game and gave Brazil a good match. So it's been a really wonderful World Cup, and to see one here in the United States on high-definition television, I'm in heaven.
Yeah, it's true that the parity is incredible now. Yeah. And, boy, that one match really does stand out. Other than that, the biggest blowouts are Germany 4-0 over Australia and Argentina, I think.
Right. And England, yeah.
4-1 there. And, again, England was wretched, but they actually did come back to 2-2 if they'd gotten the call right. So they, you know, they have that capacity, England, still to do the thing that is the premium thing you need to do, which is put the ball in the back of the net, even if they were rotten the rest of the time. And the other thing, too, I think that stands out at the tournament is how poorly the top superstars in the world have basically performed. None of them really made any significant showing in the tournament, and very few of them even put the ball in the back of the net. At least Drogba didn't. Actually, I thought Drogba played well. It's just his team had no real chance of going through. You know, Hector, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, since you did use, you have reported for the LA Times on Mexico in, you know, going back only a couple years ago, what you make of El Tri dropping out. And I don't know, I have you on the phone today, and what you make of what's going on down there right now in terms of the elections and stuff.
Oh, well, I think, you know, it's always sad to see El Tri bounce out of a tournament. And you know, and the way they went out, I mean, I was telling a friend that they went out in that last game against Argentina. I mean, all the worst things that could happen to you as a team. First, a referee's error, you know, that one goal that was obviously on offside. And then second, a horrible gaffe by the center defender. And then thirdly, and just a marvelous goal by the opponent, that incredible strike by Carlos Tevez. So that it was like three daggers to the heart for Mexico in that game. I didn't really sort of see them having the talent they've had in past World Cups. I didn't really expect them to go very far. But I know they take it really hard down there in Mexico, and our heart goes out to them. You know, Mexico is a country that is going through a really important democratic transition. I mean, I think this is something that's undercovered in the American media. I mean, the struggle to get these stories in when I was in Mexico City bureau chief, because I think there is an obligation to write about what's happening with the drug wars. But at the same time, you know, Mexico is now this, in many places, a really vital three-party democracy where you have these three main parties with very clear ideological lines and a new generation coming up who are used to having choice when they go to the ballot box. And in many towns that I visited in Mexico, I was really very hopeful for Mexican democracy, and I still am. I think the whole drug problem is something obviously that has to be dealt with. But no, I think Mexico is moving forward, and I have strong hopes for its future.
Yeah, in fact, when we spoke to Daniel Hernandez right after the victory over the French, and there was, of course, euphoria, we did bounce into the politics for a second. And, of course, one of the things is that, you know, from most of the country where most of the population lives is not the northern part of the country, and drug wars do get even a greater disproportionate amount of the attention here in the United States because they're weighted in the northern part of the country, and obviously that's closer to the United States. But, yeah, no, I mean, there's no doubt there are social crises, but that's a very good point, Hector, about where Mexican society is right now. And I know when I go down to Mexico City, I just find the most vibrant, incredible city.
Well, if I could just say one more thing about the World Cup, I think it's wonderful to see the way the World Cup can bring the United States is an increasingly cosmopolitan society, and the way it sort of brings people out, you know, to talk about all these different countries of the world, people who aren't usual soccer fans. And every World Cup, it seems to be more interesting in the United States than the World Cup. I mean, I remember going to see the 1978 World Cup at the L.A. Sports Arena because it was only available on closed-circuit television. And so I did, you know, go there with 10 or 15,000 of the fans, and I saw the Argentina-Holland final way back when. And then you go into the city, and no one would be talking about soccer. And now it's, you know, everyone is talking about the finals, and everyone has something to say, and there's all this sort of freewheeling discussion about national identity and soccer and, you know, penalty kicks. And it's just really wonderful to see the way the World Cup can bring people together.
It is, you know, and it's funny because it's one of the reasons why I found today's editorial op-ed piece from Ariel Dorfman in the LA Times so surprising. It was an op-ed piece in which he kind of reproduces the story that sort of circulates about you know, why soccer, he sort of says, you know, why, I really wish soccer would be popular one day in the United States, but it's not, and it never will be, because it has to compete with all these other sports, and kids don't want to stick with it as they grow up, because it's not lucrative, and yada, 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 you know, and I respect his writings, of course, he's a world-renowned author, but in this one point, he feels really out of touch with soccer culture nationally and with certainly soccer culture in this region, because I would not say it's not a popular sport. I would not say that it's not growing in its popularity. It just seems dead wrong, and I was disappointed to see the LA Times actually giving us that kind of thing.
No, he's definitely off. And what he misses is that soccer doesn't have the same role in our culture that it has in other cultures. In other cultures, you know, a lot of national identity is tied up with the soccer team. I mean, that's definitely true, in a country like Argentina, where, you know, that is a good part of what Argentinians think of themselves has to do with the way they, you know, almost a football, you know. Mm-hmm. The United States isn't yet obsessed, which is one of the reasons why our players are accessible, and, you know, they're still normal human beings, but in the rest of the world, people go totally crazy. But here there is, you know, there's a different strata. It's a more cosmopolitan, the international sort of segment of American society, people who have roots in another country, or people who are, you know, college educated, upper middle class, you know, who aren't afraid of turning on, you know, Bundesliga or a Premier League match or to see the Champions League. I mean, it's a significant strata of the society, and it's increasing, and there's, you know, all the stereotypes are falling out the window. I mean, even Latinos that supposedly only identify with their native team, you know, the team of their native country, I mean, there's increasing Latino support for the U.S. national team. So, you know, the country is changing. It just takes some people a little while to get caught up with what the changes are.
Did you see Glenn Beck's and other Fox News hosts' rants against the World Cup? Were you privileged to witness those beautiful acts of mass media literature?
No, I did not. I missed those. But, you know, usually the louder the dog barks, it's because they're more afraid and
mm-hmm.
There you go.
Yeah, that's been my point along with them. It's like, yeah, they're, from their point of view, yeah, they're diagnosing the situation correctly. They should fear this, you know. It's not going to help if you're a racist nativist. Hector Tobar, before we let you go, two questions, simple questions, obvious questions. Who's going to win the World Cup, and which of the four teams are you pulling for? Maybe the second question first.
I would say that I think everyone thinks Germany is going to win, so I think Holland will win. I think Holland is going to win its first ever World Cup and its third World Cup final. They're going to beat the Germans in the final. People will say that it will be the best played final since 1986, you know, since that wonderful Maradona-inspired victory of Argentina over Germany in 1986. We really haven't had a very good World Cup final, and we're going to have one this time. Dramatic, lots of goals, back and forth. And I'm gonna root for the Dutch too, because just I love the German team. I think they're really interesting, and they sort of represent this new Germany. But I'm gonna root for the Dutch just because I think the Dutch have made this incredible contribution to world football over the years, and I think they're finally gonna get rewarded for it.
Well, Hector Tobar, you can find his writings frequently on the LA Times and more frequently, apparently, on his Facebook page. So, Hector Tobar, thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game.
Thank you much for having me. Thank you.
And we're going to take a little break right now. Then we're going to come back. And after we come back, later in the show, we're going to be taking your phone calls at 818-985-5735. But right after the break, we're going to hear Laurent Dubois' thoughts about the Ghana-Uruguay match, which he attended in Johannesburg, South Africa. And this is Alan Minsky live with the People's Game here on KPFK Radio. And in a moment, we're going to hear again the words of Laurent Dubois talk about the Ghana-Uruguay match. And I'm joined in studio by
Pablo Morales,
Jennifer Doyle.
And Jennifer wants to tell people about this fantastic film that is playing, I believe, tomorrow night here in Los Angeles.
Yes, the film is Zidane, A 21st Century Portrait. And this is a film that was done in collaboration between two artists, Douglas Gordon and Philippe Pereno. And it was released in 2006. In this film, the artist trained 17 cameras on Zinedine Zidane as he played a match for Real Madrid. And it's a beautiful film in which we watch only Zidane in this match. The rest of the game is actually out of our view. It's a stunning portrait of what a footballer does as an individual within a game, but it's also a very thoughtful visual portrait of one of the world's most recognizable faces, Zidane, who this is actually filmed before the 2006 World Cup. It eerily anticipates the great story of his exit from the World Cup, which many listeners who are fans of the game well know already. But for film buffs, this is an extraordinary film. One might call it an experimental documentary. Nothing happens in this game except Zidane playing. You can hear him breathe. You can hear sounds from individual people in the audiences. There's fantastic sound visual experience to watching this film. It's scored by Mogwai. It's actually a very popular soundtrack independently because the score is so, so gorgeous. This is going to be screened courtesy of the Hammer Museum. UCLA's Hammer Museum will be showing the film in the Billy Wilder Theater on UCLA's campus. The screening starts at 7 o'clock, and tickets are actually free. Tickets will be first given to Hammer members, so it's a good reason to join if you haven't already. But so you line up if you're a member in one line. Those people are allowed into the theater first, and then the rest of the general public are allowed in afterwards. It's a great film. I recommend getting there early to get a place online, and it's just I can't recommend it enough. I'm thrilled. It's the film's first official public screening that I know of in the region. It's very hard to get a hold of, so please go see it and enjoy. It's really beautiful.
Again, that is Zidane at the Billy Wilder Theater on UCLA campus, sponsored by the Hammer Forum, 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Of course, tomorrow, midday Pacific Standard Time, the big match is Uruguay versus Holland. Uruguay's survival is due to certainly the most controversial moment in the 2010 World Cup so far. And right now we're going to hear the words of Laurent Dubois, who's the author of the book Soccer Empire. He's a professor at Duke University, taught a very popular course on global football and politics, that is global soccer and politics, this past year at Duke University. We've had him on the show before. I voice the essay, but it are the words of Laurent Dubois. Black Star Tragedy by Laurent Dubois. Football, we learned during the Ghana-Uruguay game, is the most effective tool for mass torture ever devised by the human race. A vast majority of the over 80,000 fans in the stadium and millions of viewers throughout the world were left speechless and unwound by what we saw unfold. For me, it was a little bit like reliving the final of the World Cup in 2006, with an early euphoria followed by an equalizer, then a game dragging on and on into penalties, with Guyon's missed shot at the last minute playing the role of Zidane's headbutt as the dramatic and decisive instant of the night. The sorrow, the indignity, the sense of unfairness of it all was too much to even contemplate. For many people throughout the world, the cup essentially ended yesterday with the elimination of Brazil and Ghana. For all those who hoped for a brief time that this would be the year for an African team to go further than any had before, the remaining games seem somehow sapped of meaning. The night began very differently. The atmosphere in the city was electric yesterday, with everyone in South Africa seemingly behind Ghana and the flags and emblems of the country everywhere. The symbolism of it all was, of course, great. 50 years ago, Ghana's independence began the wave of decolonization on the continent. In 1966, Ghana's president, Kwame Nkrumah, led a boycott of the World Cup by African nations unhappy with the fact that only one of the 16 berths in the competition was reserved for either an African team or an Asian team. The boycott was successful, and it set in motion a long process through which African countries have gained more power within FIFA. The South African World Cup was, in some sense, the culmination of that long process. To see Ghana advance to the semifinals, which no African country ever has in the World Cup, would have been a fitting and inspiring confirmation that things have changed, and that they can change in the world of football. Of course, there was reason to be cautious. Though Ghana was the last of the African teams in the tournament, it is a young team and weakened substantially in its striking power by the absence of Michael Essien. They had played well against the U.S., but had seemed less convincing in the group phase and only advanced thanks to the loss of Serbia to Australia. They might pull it off, we all knew, but it was going to be tough. For the game, however, most had thrown caution to the wind. You could find a few small Uruguay flags to buy on the way into Soccer City, but mostly it was every kind of merchandise in the colors of Ghana. Fans from all over the world decked themselves out in Ghana scarves. I picked up a rather handsome one myself. Ghana hats, Ghana gloves, Ghana face paint, and waved small and large Ghana flags. There were, of course, groups of the famous stalwart Black Star fans as well. Everyone knew what the right outcome was, it seemed. And as the game began, it seemed like Ghana was in a position to win. They played beautifully. They were exciting to watch. They charged the goal, seeking openings in the tough Uruguayan defense, and seemed technically superior in many of the encounters. And then came Muntari's goal. The rest of the story is, I cannot bear to run through it, but that it so happened that an Uruguay defender, pushing the ball out with his hands, prevented a Ghanaian goal, and that what football can offer in response is a penalty kick. And that it fell to Guyan, a young player who on a team without Essien had come to bear the burden of Ghana's attack, to take that penalty, and who under the pressure hit the bar. And that the burden of the loss falls on him rather than on the Uruguayan who cheated, and that this, it seems, simply devastated the team, which was not able to rally effectively during the penalty kicks, and that all of the urging on, the beautiful cacophony and integrated vuvuzelas of the crowd, the millions of prayers, among them mine, repeatedly spoken during the match, that all of that led to what it did is unbearable. To watch Guyan, sobbing uncontrollable, consoled by his teammates on the pitch, was, like the entire match, purely gut-wrenching. Last night I went through several possible responses. The first and certainly the most reasonable is simply to forever swear off football. This has several advantages. After all, we're the ones who let it into our lives, who let it torture us like this, and we have the power to politely show at the door and ask it to take its leave. We would save a lot of money and time and can devote ourselves to nobler causes of all kinds or to the pleasures of gardening or spending time with family. It's a good option overall and one I'm seriously considering following. One can also, of course, consider that often proposed response, which is to put it in perspective. On the long walk back to the buses from Soccer City, surrounded by a lugubrious atmosphere among the fans, I tried to take consolation remembering all the World Cup matches that had similarly been determined by the heinous crime against humanity that is the penalty kick shootout. Germany-France, 1982, for instance, when Platini's generation of French players perhaps came closest to winning the World Cup. Guyan takes his place among many generations of excellent players who have suffered what he did yesterday, and unlike some of them, like Roberto Baggio in the 1994 final against Brazil, he is still young, and he and his teammates have much ahead of them that will perhaps come to surpass, if never erase, this memory. You can, of course, go into a World Cup match agnostic, divided, watching out of curiosity what will happen, happy with any outcome. The problem, of course, is that I wouldn't trade anything for having been fully there last night, part of the crowd, sharing in each gesture of the Ghanaian team. It has been a long time since I have experienced that much stress during a game. During the penalty kicks, like a kid watching a horror movie, I literally sat down on my chair with my head in my hands, unable to watch. But I could count on the sound of 80,000 people to tell me what was going on. I knew when things looked up briefly, and I knew we had lost when, in the stadium, after hours of constant and intense noise, there was nothing but the sound of tens of thousands of sighs. The whole experience was both unbearable and irreplaceable, and at the end it was probably best to have company, to hug friends afterwards, to commiserate with looks as we walked out, to try and marshal a few enthusiastic chants nonetheless. Right now, besides writing this out and then thinking of other things, I think the best solution, one that is, after all, the only approach to surviving in life with some sense of balance and joy, is perhaps to hold on tightly to a particular time from last night, that stretch of minutes between Muntari's goal before halftime and Forlan's goal in the second half, the time when there was the buzz of hope, always tempered by an undercurrent of fear, of course, the time when what is now impossible, briefly, seemed possible. Laurent Dubois, Johannesburg, South Africa. This is Alan Minsky here in live at KPFK, and I am joined by
Pablo Morales,
Jennifer Doyle,
and I believe we have a correction on the location of the Zidane film.
Yes, I misrepresented the location of the theater. It's the Billy Wilder Theater, and it's actually part of the Hammer Museum, which is at Wilshire and Westwood, and you can actually park in the museum garage. I think that's a very reasonable fee for that, and the film itself is free. So that's at 7 o'clock tomorrow. Zidane, a 21st century portrait.
And we are now going to go to listener phone calls. And before we take the first call, who will be Herb in Long Beach, I just want to let people know to call in at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. We're going to ask what's on your mind. We're also going to ask who you think is going to win the tournament. And on that point, I want to refer people back to yesterday's interview with Nigel Boyle, who taught a course at Pitzer College this past spring semester, the last semester, on World Cup football and the politics of global football and the history of global football, the most popular course in the history of the Claremont colleges. And at the end of the course, the 300 students and the professors, they gave predictions on every game in the tournament. And the four semifinalists they ended up with were Spain, Germany, Holland, and Ghana.
Wow.
So if not for Mr. Suarez's hand, they would have been 4-for-4. They predicted the USA would win their group, for instance. Incredible
wow.
predictions. Listen to yesterday's interview, and if you want to get a gambling tip, you want to know, because they at the very end of the interview, Nigel Boyle says who they predicted then would win.
And
okay?
that's archived on our website, thepeoplesgame.org.
Right. So there's
it's better than the octopus in Germany.
So there you go. So if you want to figure out, if you want to know how to do prognostication in sports, take a year-long, semester-long course. Now we go to Herb in Long Beach. Welcome to the People's Game, Herb.
Oh, hi. The last time people said Uruguay couldn't possibly win was 1950 at Maracanã.
that's for sure, man.
So that means I have to support Uruguay.
Yeah.
But I remember when I was studying for the bar back when Maradona was winning the tournament against Germany, I could listen to Radio Caracol or radio from Mexico City or radio from about a dozen other places and listen to the tournament. Now, if you look at the L.A. Times, you can listen to radio, ESPN. And if you listen to ESPN Deportes, it's really strange. ESPN Deportes is in English. The only place you can hear, radio in Spanish isn't listed in the L.A. Times and isn't listed in ESPN. Hmm. And I find that really, really strange because there was a front-page story about the refereeing in the tournament in the L.A. Times, and they mentioned specifically the Spanish language network that is doing the games on the radio. But if you look in the sports section, that network is not in the LA Times, but it's on the radio.
Yeah,
that's very common with the LA Times, and they're very poor. They're not very thorough when it comes to where you can watch football on television or listen to it on the radio, and it's historic, you know.
You know, I was actually, I had a moment of being appalled with one of my fellow public radio stations, the KPCC, on the day when Mexico was playing their first match and they were talking about major sporting events, because I don't know if you know this, but on that station they now do hourly updates on sports events.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about the Lakers game against the Celtics. Okay, that makes sense. It was the day of Game 7, so whoever Mexico was playing, they didn't even mention that Mexico was playing.
Right.
And it's to Southern California audiences.
Why don't you go ahead and let the audience know where they can hear a Spanish broadcast on the radio? Herb?
It's 97.5 Radio de Primera, which is also known as Radio Jose, but they can listen to Andres Cantor, Marcelo Balboa, who used to play for the U.S. team,
mm-hmm.
Carlos El Pibe Valderrama, who used to play for the Colombian mm-hmm. team, Carlos Valderrama, who used to play for the Mexican team,
mm-hmm.
and two or three other announcers who are there in South Africa, of course, and they'll be on at 6:30 or 7 o'clock tomorrow morning with the first semifinal game.
Hey, well, thank you so much, Herb, for joining us here. We have a call coming in from Ghana, actually a person from Ghana, Ghanaian. But before that, I also want to mention that at 9 p.m. on Wednesday, the KPFK Spanish language World Cup show of Football Popular will be back on KPFK 9 p.m. this Wednesday. And up next, my eyesight is bad here, but El Chuyo is calling from the 101 South, and he is from Ghana. Welcome to KPFK and the People's Game.
Oh, thank you so much. It's Akuyo, and yes, I'm in the 101 South going home. I just wanted to say that, you know, with all due respect to Uruguay, for me, Ghana won that game. I just think it's despicable that he was allowed to do what he did and get away with it. And I'm certain that had that been Ghana that did that, there would have been an uproar and probably, you know, it would have been allowed to go through. So Ghana, I'm just so proud of them. I think they've come a long way, and they're young, and like you said before, I think they, you know, Ghana's a team to watch in the future. But I just had to say, you know, Uruguay, I love you, but that was just despicable.
Well, Akuya, thank you so much. And, you know, by the way, we had a great conversation with people from the Keita Sandlanders from Ghana. And since that match, I haven't, on the People's Game, we had them on right after they defeated the United States. But I just didn't have it in me to call them up and talk to them after that. And hopefully we'll get them on the phone again in the next few days. And I also want to point out to people who maybe aren't that familiar with the Ghana team or global soccer before the World Cup, Michael Essien, the star who is absent from the team, I often have talked about the top 20 players in the world. Mm-hmm. He clearly is in the top 10 players in the world and may very well be the best central midfielder who's not a strict attacker in the world right now. And that's this team really would have been something and a half.
They were something and a half even without him. I think, in a way, what we got to see in his absence was the strength of that side as a whole.
Sure.
And I'm going to say, Akuyo, as I've been learning more about the team, one of the things that I've grown to love the most about the Ghanaian football squad is the music. There are so many fabulous Ghanaian hip life and pop songs celebrating that team using, I think they're called, is it Jama? They're songs that are sung in the stands and that have been integrated into some fabulous anthems. So I encourage people to get on the web and acquaint yourself with Ghanaian contemporary music, because it is all about the game.
If I can say something, one of the things about, you know, historical perspective in the World Cup is very, very, very few people remember who lose quarterfinal games, except when it's cases like what happened against Ghana and Uruguay. This will definitely go down in World Cup history. In some ways, you know, they will not be forgotten, you know.
That's right.
Oh, it's the defining moment of the tournament so far.
So far.
Yeah. It sure is. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Akuya.
Thank you for
calling in. And up next is Guillermo in Los Angeles. Welcome to the People's Game, Guillermo.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fine, thank you. I'm just want to say that I tried to see the games as objective as possible, and I've been following Soccer Cup since 1970. Mm-hmm. And pertaining to this game of Ghana and Uruguay, I believe that the play was something that is allowed within the game, the rules of the game, and for that the person has to pay the consequences. The first was that he got the penalty against his team, and second, he was expelled from the game. There is nothing unspeakable or nothing that is bad. It's just he plays with the rules and the team pays the consequences. And I wanted to say the player from Ghana will convert the opportunity of the penalty, the game will be won by Ghana, and we'll have no discussion about that, and Ghana will have move on. That case will be worse what happened to England, that actually was able to equalize to Germany, and the goal was not validated by the referee or by the linesman, and actually they actually went down eventually. We lost the game. That is what happened to the game is part of the game and part of the rules. If any person is going to touch the ball when the goal is the ball is going to get into their side, they have the right to touch it and they have to pay the consequences. And that's part completely of the game.
I totally agree with Guillermo on this one. You know, I the tragedy was that it's the first African World Cup. It's the last African team. They're holding, you know, the hopes, quite literally, of millions and millions and millions of people on their shoulders. And it's a tragedy more that in my opinion, that Guyon missed the penalty, you know, that would have sent Ghana through. I know we've had this discussion over and over again, but I totally agree.
I want to say something else, that yes, in the game that Paraguay played Spain, they convert the goal that was valid and actually was not allowed by the referee. If that will have to change the whole strategy of the game, and maybe Paraguay will have beat Spain, and again Mexico, Argentina. Argentina was validating a goal that was not valid, and that throw you off the whole team of Mexico. They make a mistake, and the whole concentration, because at that time they were playing better than Argentina, and they were dominating the game, and throw them off. In that case, there are many unfair calls and injustice done on the field that change the way the game was played and the outcome of the match. In that case, there are many other things that happen in this World Cup that it will continue to happen unless the FIFA doesn't remain archaic in the way they conduct the sport. and actually will favor to everyone and will have the implementation of the technology as it does in any other sport or many other sports that takes place. But in reality, I want to say that I don't know who can win, because any call from a referee in any of those two games left, it could decide the outcome of the match. Hmm. And well, actually, it's sad to see it. It's sad that it happens, but it may happen. Even between Germany and Spain, it may happen, something in favor of one of the two teams, even with red cards or yellow cards.
Right.
A team like Germany has three fouls in the first 5 minutes of the game, and none of the three fouls.
We're having some interference there on your phone, Guillermo. I apologize. But thank you for the illuminating comments. And by the way, I don't know if you guys saw the Dutch goalkeeper said that commented on Suarez as a great goaltender. Not just that he cheated, but actually the save was an exceptional save.
I just want to say that a lot of the mortgage collapse, the collapse of our housing market, happened. You know, it was executed by people who were playing by the rules. You know, just because they're playing by the rules, it doesn't make their actions okay or right or ethical.
That's iffy.
That's a stretch.
There are unethical business practices involved in that. Richie from Richie in North Hollywood. I think I know Richie, and I think I know he's a big German partisan. Congratulations on your team's great showing so far, Richie.
Yeah, thank you very much. And Alan, I want to, as a big Azzurri fan, I want to thank you for being so fair. And
sure.
Your assessment of the Germans. Oh, I know it doesn't come easy.
It's killing him inside.
Yeah, I know. I could see, but he was so brave the way he carried himself and executed his duties as program director. My hat, you know, the whole Italian side should be proud of you, because I think you were the best player they had.
Best composure, that's for sure.
Thank you, Richie. So, Richie, do you think the Germans? Okay, there's your heart, and then there's your efforts to be objective when your team is doing so well. How do you think the Germans will do against Spain?
You know, I haven't wanted to jinx the team all tournament, and so far I've done pretty well. The most fun I have is that I was watching Argentina play Mexico, and I was watching with all these Spanish speakers, and they were saying, oh, Argentina's going to kill Germany. And I said, did you even watch the first match this morning? They said, no. I said, watch those highlights, then come talk to me. And
well, Richie, we're getting great amount of static on your phone, so thank you so much, and thank you for the kind thoughts about me. Not necessarily all merited. I do my best. And that finally, the final call we have time for is with Menno in Montebello. Welcome to KPFK, Menno. We got about 30 seconds left.
Okay, y'all. I just want to say, great show. You enlightened me a little bit about the history of Ghana and and FIFA in regards to Africa, but I'm looking at Germany taking this. That's what I'm going to put my money on, and for good reason. They played great ball, and while they took care of Argentina for us, Mexico fans there too.
And then
Ira Abogado. She's
fantastic. Thank you so much, Menno. We are out of time. So this is the People's Game. We're going to go back to our daily podcast, which you can find on www.kpfk.org. Click on where it says Pacifica Radio, the People's Game on the right column, and then follow it to the archives of the show. They come up daily. You can also find it at www.thepeoplesgame.org. I'm Alan Minsky.
This is Pablo Morales.
And I'm Jennifer Doyle.
And again, look for tomorrow's podcast on those two websites. Thank you, D'Angelo Jones.